Hey, hey, it's your girl KV.
And Celine.
And we are back with another episode of the Hood Health Report. Today we have a guest. We have attorney Kevin Childress with us today to talk about estate planning. So it's a very controversial topic, I guess, in the Black community, because a lot of people feel like, well, if we don't, that's for rich people to do. You know, if we don't have a whole lot of money and assets to hand off to our children, then, you know, what's the purpose? So we're going to get into that today. But first, we're going to start with some this or that questions. So with this or that, we'll just kind of, you know, give you a choice between two things and you'll give us your take on it or your experience with it, and then we'll answer following you.
Okay.
So the first one is HBCU or PWI?
Oh, goodness. Starting off tough, huh? I would say, even though I did not attend an HBCU,
mm-hmm.
I would say HBCU, especially these days. It seems like the overall thought pattern people's how they feel about HBCUs mm-hmm. has kind of changed. We've got more notable people that are now attending HBCUs. Mm-hmm. And I think they certainly have their place in society. With the way society is today, with it becoming more of the have and have nots, I think African-American students and minority students in general need a safe space to express themselves. And so I totally support HBCUs. I have a number of friends that attended HBCUs, a number of attorney friends, a number of judges that attended HBCUs.
Mm-hmm.
And I can attest, even though I did not attend an HBCU, to the quality of the product that comes out of HBCU.
Okay, and what school did you attend?
Undergrad, I attended Austin Peay.
Okay.
In Clarksville, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Austin Peay had just started heavily recruiting from West Tennessee. And so most of the individuals, students that I attended, or the African-American students, were from Memphis or from West Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a few from Nashville. And so Austin Peay was considered what you would say, call a suitcase college, meaning that on the weekends, most people that were close enough to go home would go home.
Mm-hmm.
But with us living in all the way across the state mm-hmm. in West Tennessee, we couldn't go home. You know, it wasn't as easy. And so on the weekends, it pretty much be, you know, the black folks
on campus. Right.
And so.
Sounds like a time, though.
Yeah. So that was, that was undergrad. And then for law school, I went to UT, Knoxville.
Okay.
And a totally different experience. Obviously a much larger school, even
Very.
Though, you know, for the most part, I was confined to the law school mm-hmm. environment. But it was a culture shock. Although Clarksville was a majority Caucasian, I guess, area, we had the, you know, people from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, that would come down, you know, that were African American, and like I said, the other students. But with Knoxville, I mean, that was a total culture shock,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you know, I guess I'm proud to have graduated from UT Knoxville, but that Knoxville was certainly not a place that I wanted to live, you know, I'll just say that. But so yeah, Austin Peay, go Govs, undergrad and UT law school.
I had my heart set on UT for some reason. I guess because they visited my high school a lot and they did like a lot of trips where it would take us overnight and everything, but I ended up not going to UT. I ended up going to an HBCU, thank God.
Uh-huh.
Spelman undergrad
yeah.
and graduate school, I went to University of Memphis for my master's.
Okay.
I went to the University of Memphis for undergrad and graduate. I was a student athlete. If I could do it again, I would go to HBCU just because I wanted that experience. But with scholarships, it's more likely that you get a better scholarship if you go to a Division I school.
Right.
So that's where I ended up. So yeah, that's
right.
My story.
Right. And I'll say this about, I got scholarships to Austin Peay,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so that sometimes dictates where you go.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
why I was about to go to UT.
You know,
that's
right,
definitely.
Right. So what athlete?
I run track and field. I do the 400, 800, 4x4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, mid distance.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. I don't run no more, but used to do it. And then the next question is private practice or public defender? Which do you prefer?
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Because actually, I started off as a public defender. When I graduated law school, moved back here to Memphis, and did a year and a half at the PD's office. And I would say that I gained a lot of valuable experience because you're thrown out into the, you're thrown to the wolves. I mean, in terms of having to be in court and learning the ins and outs of in court procedure and process. You know, obviously the pay, you know, that always factors in. You know, any public sector job, the pay is a factor. Mm-hmm. And so after about a year and a half, I started kind of, from before that, I started kind of moonlighting with a lawyer that was in private practice. His name is J.C. McLean. He passed away. He actually was a judge before he passed away on the appellate court. So I started working with him and kind of on the side. And he convinced me to come out into private practice. And I've enjoyed it. I mean, depending on what you do with private practice, I mean, you still have the opportunity to give back. And I think even more so. I mean, with any job, public sector, public defender's office, you're kind of confined to what to the help that you can provide.
Right.
You know, and the kind of myth, I guess, or the assumption with the public defender's office being overworked and, you know, and all that, that is true. Because they have so many cases, and it's only so much that you can do, you know, when you have such a large caseload. Now, I will commend the public defenders. I believe they do a good job, but with the limited resources, I think that plays a factor. And it's my understanding that the actual public defender here has been lobbying for additional funding to kind of increase the, you know, the effectiveness of the PD's office. But I guess to answer the question, this or that, I would say private practice.
Okay, and our last question for this or that, coffee or tea? How do you get your day started?
Okay. I am a coffee guy. But I recently discovered that I am highly allergic to caffeine.
Oh.
It causes me to feel very bloated. And I didn't know what it was. I thought it was dairy, you know, which I am kind of lactose intolerant.
We all are.
Yeah. And so I found out from kind of process of elimination that it's caffeine. And so.
Do you like decaf or?
Well, I found out that even decaf has a certain amount of
caffeine in it. Still. Yeah. And even some teas have some caffeine in it.
Yeah. But I mean, that's not to say that I won't
won't indulge
a cup of coffee. You know, so I would say coffee. You know, if I'm sitting at the office and I've drunk a cup of coffee, then if sitting still, then it's just going to hit me. You know? But if I know I'm going to kind of be active and not just sitting in one place, and I'll still, you know, get a cup of coffee.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I am a both type of person these days. For a while, I was a tea drinker, but now that I've been on this workout journey and this, you know, health stuff, I've been drinking protein shakes, and it's just so much easier to like add a little bit of instant coffee into the protein shake to kind of give you that boost for the rest of the day. So I'm kind of 50-50. I do a little bit of both.
Okay.
If I'm out and about, it's definitely coffee. If I'm making it at the house, it's tea. But growing up, my grandma, she drinks coffee every day. And I used to stay at her house. We drank coffee every day. Like as a child, I was always the tea and the coffee every day. So I definitely drink tea and coffee every day. Like there's not many days where I just skip a complete day. I tell myself I'm going to try, but it's just, I just need a cup of tea or coffee, something to get my day started.
I used to drink coffee or cappuccinos with my grandmother as well. Start the day with some scrambled eggs and a little cappuccino. And
I would tend to drink coffee more in the colder weather, like the colder, you know, than summer.
See, I just do an iced coffee.
I drink everything hot. So, like, even in the summertime, I'm still drinking hot coffee. So, I don't know what's wrong with me. I be trying to switch over to the ice, but I can't switch.
I'm not an iced coffee.
Yeah, I ain't got there yet.
I will do an iced coffee in a minute. Like I said, I'll mix it with my protein shake. So, I'll do, like, a banana in the blender, the protein powder, a little bit of coffee, maybe like some flavoring, like a little shot of caramel or something like that, and just blend it on up, and that'll be breakfast for the day.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to try that.
A little blended coffee protein treat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now that the this or that section is done, uh-huh. we're gonna hop into some interview questions or just questions in general that we feel like you would be able to give us a little better insight on.
Okay.
The first thing that I wanted to ask was just for you to give us a little bit more information about yourself and how did you end up in your career? Like, what made you decide that this is what you wanted to do?
Okay. So I don't have this, you know, the usual story that I grew up wanting to be a lawyer. I don't really have that story. And frankly, I ended up going to law school because I was about to graduate from Austin Peay and really didn't have a plan. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what was going to be the next step. I knew I wanted to continue my education. Mm-hmm. I majored in business management, and that's a very stressful, and the opportunities weren't all that great. And so I had a fraternity brother that was in law school at Vanderbilt. And he was kind of influential, you know, in my life. And so he's like, man, you ought to go to law school. And so me and another frat brother, we was at Austin Peay. We came to Memphis and took a study course for the LSAT. And I managed to do pretty well on the LSAT. Got in, accepted to, you know, a few law schools and chose UT Knoxville. And so that's how I ended up, you know, in law school. And then from there, so your question was, where did I?
How did you end up in your career field?
Oh, okay. All right, so after graduating from law school, like I mentioned, I came back here, then got hired by the public defender's office. Worked there for a year and a half, and then I came out into private practice, basically doing criminal law, because obviously that's what I was used to doing with mm-hmm. the public defender's office. So I handled criminal law for probably 7 or 8 years. Frankly, got burnt out with it. The lawyer that I mentioned that was the judge, that ended up being a judge, McLean, he, at that point, just got, after I worked with him for about a year and a half, he got appointed to the criminal court judgeship. He took actually, do y'all know Judge Joe Brown?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Judge Joe Brown was actually an actual judge here in Memphis. And so after Judge Joe Brown left his seat, McLean was appointed to Judge Joe Brown's seat. McLean kind of had more of a general practice. He did criminal because he was a former prosecutor. He did criminal, but he also did other things, personal injury cases, probate, and things of that nature. So once he took on the judgeship, then, of course, that left his practice to me to kind of take over things. And so I kind of got into the probate side of things. And from there, I started handling some cases for the Cochran firm and some of the other larger firms that handle, like, wrongful death cases and nursing home neglect mm-hmm. cases. And so with those cases, you need the probate side of it mm-hmm. because you have to have somebody appointed to proceed with assisting with that nursing home case or wrongful death case. And so that's really how I got into probate law. And then from there, of course, estate planning, that is, you know, hand in hand with the probate side. Mm-hmm. Because obviously if you have somebody that dies and, you know, then you're looking to see whether they had a will or trust or whatever the case may be, something set up. And so that's how I kind of got into it. I've been in practice for 28 years. I've been doing mostly probate along for the past 20 years. In addition, I am outside counsel for Methodist Hospital, like on their probate stuff. Mm-hmm. So like just say if they have a patient that is mentally disabled, then you may need somebody to be appointed as their conservator. Mm-hmm. And so I help them with that. I also do some part-time work for the county with delinquent taxes. Sometimes I will sit as a special judge in probate court. Like if the judge is on vacation mm-hmm. or out on conference or something, they'll have, you know, private lawyers to come in and sit as substitute judges. And so that's really kind of how I got my start. I had some, you know, while in Knoxville, I had some unfortunate incidents with law enforcement, as most Black men can sometimes find themselves involved in.
Right.
You know, obviously I was never convicted of anything. Police kind of rolled up on me and some of my buddies of mine that was sitting out actually watching a, what's my guy from here that's a preacher? He's saying, Al Green was in Knoxville. And we were sitting out across from where he was performing at one of my friend's apartments. And so the police just rolled up on us and, you know, just and took us into custody. And so all the, you know, nothing became of it, but that, I guess, is part of my motivation. Mm-hmm. That's really what kind of led me into the criminal side, you know, in terms of wanting to see justice for, you know, people that have been charged with offenses, and then kind of went, you know, kind of went from there, you know, so. Mm-hmm.
To,
you know, the average, yeah.
Okay. So probate, so you've got the probate side, which is, you know, the pretty much the court side of things.
Okay.
Then you've got the estate planning side. So when you talk about the probate or the court side, your typical processes, I guess, that occur on that side, most people have heard of an estate. So an estate is when a person passes away and they leave assets either through a will or through what's called intestacy, and I'll explain that. Those assets need to pass through probate to whoever the next of kin are.
Okay.
And so you have to have someone that petitions the court to open an estate, and the assets are, there's, you know, a lot of steps to that process, and then ultimately the funds that are left through the estate pass to either the heirs or the beneficiaries of the will. So when a person passes away and leaves a will, that's called a testate estate. And so the person that's appointed over that estate is called the executor. And I'm pretty sure most people have heard of that term.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a person dies without a will, that's called an intestate estate. And so with an intestate estate, let me back up. So with a will, the person's assets, the deceased person's assets, pass to whoever they named in that will.
Mm-hmm.
If a person dies without a will, then their assets pass intestate, and according to how Tennessee law has set up, mm-hmm. who gets the assets. And that's typically the spouse and kids. If there are no spouse or kids, then it goes to the deceased person's parents. If there are no parents, then it goes out. So the simple way to kind of remember it is down, up, and out. So spouse and kids, up to the parents, and if there are no parents, then out to the siblings or children of deceased siblings. So that's how that works if a person dies without a will. So that's an estate. Also on the probate side, you have conservatorships. A conservatorship is a process where you have a person that's still alive, that's an adult, but they're incapacitated. They're unable to make their own medical and financial decisions. And so you have to have a person appointed by the court to be able to assist with those decisions. That has become a highly litigated area, because as people are living longer, that there's the more likelihood that they will suffer some sort of mental or physical disability.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into folks fighting over who's going to be the conservator. You know, those can be some of the most drawn out and nasty of cases that you can imagine.
Mm.
You know, and when it's supposed to be all about what is in the best interest of the disabled person, it becomes all about power struggles, mm-hmm. and gaining assets and all that. So then you've got the estate, you've got the conservatorship, then you've got guardianships. Mm-hmm. So a guardianship is where you have a minor that may not be disabled other than the fact that they're under 18, that may be entitled to receive money. Mm-hmm. Just say grandma passed away, left a life insurance policy with grandchild who's a minor as the beneficiary. Well, a minor cannot receive assets directly. And so in most cases, a guardianship has to be open for someone to be appointed to receive those funds and manage the funds on behalf of the, you know, of that minor child.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of the three main court proceedings as it relates to the probate side. There's also a process called a muniment of title. That's where a person leaves a will, but their only asset is a house. And as opposed to having to open a full probate, you can do what's called a muniment of title to just pass that house to whoever it goes to. Then you have what's called a small estate. That's a process where if a person leaves assets that are under $50,000, the law allows, in certain circumstances, for a small estate to be opened, so you don't have to go through that long process of a full probate estate. And then probate also does name changes. So those are kind of the main areas when you talk about probate or probate court. Mm-hmm. One other process that can be filed in probate is called a partition suit. That's when, just say if somebody dies, leaves a house, there are multiple people that now own the house. Somebody want to sell, you know. And so the law doesn't mandate that everybody owns this house together. And so either one of those individuals can force a sale of the house. Mm-hmm. Just say if us three own the property together, mm-hmm. you all want to keep the house, but I want to sell to get my money out of it. Mm-hmm. I can force the property to be sold. And so that's called a partition lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And those used to be kind of simple, but over time it seems like that they, you know, can have become kind of drawn out, particularly if you got the person that doesn't want to sell that's living in the house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they don't want to get out. And so now you got to get a judge to, you know, issue an order for the sheriff to come and put them out. You know, I'm dealing with one of those now. Unfortunately, I
have a question.
Okay.
So, like you said, so us two didn't want to sell, but you want to sell.
Uh-huh.
And even though it's two of us and one of you, that they would still have to legally.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was like a majority
in
that case.
No, either one. I mean, if it's 20 that.
Yeah.
There's and 19 want to keep and one want to sell.
I did not know
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Now, there are two things. So there's what's called a partition for sale. That's when it's the property sold, and it's called a partition in kind, K-I-N-D, where if the plot of land is large enough, it can be subdivided.
Mm.
You know, just say if it's three of us and it's, you know, 300 acres.
Yeah.
you know, we can subdivide, you get your 100 and so on, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way that a property, you know, can not actually be sold, but subdivided. So that's another kind of situation that could be filed in probate court. Those are also filed in chancery court, but they can be filed in probate as well. So that's kind of the, so that's the probate side, the court side. So the estate planning side, so that mainly consists of, and the most common, obviously, the document there is the last will and testament. Mm-hmm. That's the document where a person, you know, just simply names the assets are and who they want that asset to go to. They also have to name an executor, like I mentioned, the executor, who they want to carry out their last wishes. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much, you know, that's the last will and testament. Then, you know, kind of up from there, then you get into trust. So the trust is kind of the hot button kind of topic these days. Do I need a trust? Do I not need a trust?
Mm-hmm.
So the primary, I guess, selling point or the perceived advantage of a trust is, well, this is, we're trying to keep everything out of court. And for the most part, a trust that is designed to keep the case, mm-hmm. the you know, people out of probate court.
Mm-hmm.
So with a trust, and the most common trust is called a revocable living trust. And it's revocable, meaning that it can be terminated, it can be modified, you can place assets into the trust, you can take assets out of the trust, so it's flexible.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you name who your trustee is gonna be, and then you name who you want your beneficiaries to be once you pass away. And it's called a living trust because it can be administrated and things can be done through the trust while the person that created the trust is still living.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have an irrevocable trust. That's a trust, as the name kind of implies. Once it's set up, it cannot be modified. Once you place assets in the trust, they're in there. Mm-hmm. You can't terminate it. Well, there's a term called decanting. That's a process that you can potentially change or modify an irrevocable trust, but it's very difficult to do so. most people will go with the revocable trust because of the flexibility.
Right.
And most people, frankly, don't have really the need for an irrevocable trust. Mm-hmm. Irrevocable trust kind of protects from creditors and things of that nature. But most people have things set up to where it's really not that type of situation.
I was going to say, what situation would someone use an irrevocable trust?
Well, the main point of it is to actually shield the asset, you know, from... If somebody sues you, then you no longer own that asset. Mm. And so if it's somebody that's subject to being sued, things of that nature, then that's more of a reason for an irrevocable trust because you no longer own that asset. Now, technically, you no longer own the asset with a revocable trust, but because you can take the asset back out and own it again, mm-hmm. you don't have that same solid protection. Mm-hmm. You know, but so it's kind of on a case-by-case, you know, basis of, you know, of which one a person needs. I do plenty more revocables than I do irrevocable. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a sort of irrevocable trust that's called a special needs trust. But that trust is designed for people that have a disability that may be entitled to receive like federal benefits, Medicaid, and things of that nature. And so any assets that go into a special needs irrevocable trust are not counted as an asset. So that person can still qualify for Medicaid, Choices program, and all those things. And so that's another form of irrevocable trust. So we've got the will, we've got the various trusts. Let me mention one other trust. It's called a qualified income trust or a Miller's trust. And so that type of trust is where a person just say, receives income, but say they need to go into a facility for rehab, mm-hmm. but their income is above what they could, that income is higher than what they could qualify for, you know, Medicaid or whatever. And so if their income is placed into this Miller's Trust, then they can qualify for treatment and rehab and all those things. So that's really, that one is kind of more of a temporary type situation.
Okay.
But so you've got the Miller's Trust. So we got the will, we've got the trust, then we have powers of attorney. So there are two types of power of attorney. One is called a general durable power of attorney. That's for like day-to-day financial and business-related affairs. So that's when a person says, hey, they're of sound mind, they're able to make their own decisions, and they say, hey, maybe mother says, I want daughter to be able to assist me with go to the bank for me, pick up medicine for me, talk to creditors or whatever, then they will sign a power of attorney allowing that person to make those decisions. So unlike a conservatorship, so with a conservatorship, the person that's under the conservatorship loses their rights. Mm-hmm. Their rights are transferred to the conservator, so they can no longer make medical and financial decisions. Mm-hmm. But with a power of attorney, that person does not lose their rights, they're just giving somebody else the right to assist them.
Okay.
So you've got the general durable, then you've got the durable power of attorney for healthcare. So that one is for specifically for major healthcare decisions. Just say if mama goes in the hospital and needs some kind of major medical procedure performed. If mama is able to make her own decision, then mama can make that decision. But if not, if somebody has been appointed as her healthcare mm-hmm. power of attorney, that person can make that healthcare decision, up to and including do not resuscitate, mm-hmm. CPR, and all that.
Then the other document in the movies.
Yeah. Then you have the other document that kind of goes along with the powers of attorney. It's called a living will. So unlike the last, so sometimes people get the living will and last will and testament mixed up. So the last will and testament is where you give your assets to whoever. The living will is where a person expresses their wishes regarding whether or not they want to be kept on life support or not.
Okay.
And so that's what the living will does. So those are, you know, those are the primary documents. The probate side, that's the court proceeding, you know, the opening of estate, conservatorship, guardianship, partition lawsuit and all that. And then the estate planning side is, like I mentioned, the will, the powers of attorney, and the trust.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So while we're there, while you're saying that, what is the difference between a will and a trust?
Okay. So with a will, when a person, first off, in order for a will to be valid, of course, the person has to pass away first, and then the will actually has to be presented to the probate court judge to be reviewed and what we call admitted to probate. And usually in a will, the assets in the will pass immediately, you know, to the beneficiaries of the will. So as opposed to a trust where there is some, again, like we mentioned, the overall objective is to keep the person from having to even go to court.
Yeah.
But with the distribution of the assets, there's more control of when those assets are distributed. So like I mentioned with the will, it's pretty much, you know, you get everything in one lump sum. There are things you can put in a will to kind of, you know, as alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
But with a trust, you have some control over, you know, when a person gets their asset. So if you got minor beneficiaries, you know, or you got an adult that's not responsible, and you don't want this person to get, you don't want this person to get $25,000 at one time.
Okay.
You know, then you can say, I want him to get $10,000 at this age, or $10,000, you know, you can set it up that way.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, like with minors, most people say, look, I want them to get, you know, 25% when they get 18, 25% at 21 or 25, whatever, and then the rest at 30, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of those are the main kind of differences, you know, whether or not you got to go to court in the first place, and then the level of control you have over when the beneficiary receives the asset. Yeah, but let me say this. Some people have the misconception that just because I have a trust, it's going to be kept out of court.
Yeah.
Not so. Any document that exists, any situation that exists, somebody can sue.
Mm.
You know, if a person feels like that they were wrongfully left out of the trust, or, you know, the person didn't have the capacity to sign the trust, you know, those are still things that can be, you know, litigated. And in fact, I'm dealing with two or three contested litigated trust matters as we speak. You know, if the trustee didn't do what he was supposed to do, you know, I've got one case where the trustee was supposed to sell the property through the trust, put the money in the trust, and the money go to certain beneficiaries. Well, he sells the property outside the trust and gives it to the intestate. You remember I mentioned the intestate, children, all that. He gives it to them.
He did what he wanted to do.
He did what he wanted to do.
So does that mean he would get sued, or like?
Okay, and the crazy part about that?
No.
Okay. No. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but to answer the question, yes, he would get sued.
Uh-huh.
Crazy part about this case. Okay, so the grantor, that's the lady that created the trust. She made a handwritten change to the trust, where she eliminated some of the beneficiaries and added others. The trustee is one of the added beneficiaries. So he has the nerve, he initiates the lawsuit for the judge to determine that he's a beneficiary, even though he messed the whole trust up. So I guess he's just gonna say, you know, let the chips fall where they may. So he started the lawsuit. And so now I got contacted by two of the people that were named in this amendment that were not in the first part of the trust. And so you know, my office is representing two of them, but obviously we're making a big deal about how he messed up and sold the property, the house, and the money didn't even come in the trust. So, you know, that one's, but my point is, I think having a trust does eliminate the likelihood of having to go to court at all. But if there's something that may come up, you know, there's still the possibility of it ending up in court anyway.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
So I read an article, and I'm going to name off a little bit about it, and then I'm going to ask you a question, too.
Okay.
It says that research shows that fewer Black Americans will have a will or estate plan when they die compared to white Americans. And then it says that 70% of Black Americans in 2021 didn't have an estate plan at all. It also went on to say that after 2020 when the pandemic hit, that the median Black household wealth was forecast to hit zero by 2053 mm-hmm. In 2017, but since the pandemic, it has sped up. So my question to you is, do you, a lot of Black people feel that they don't have enough assets to do estate planning. Do you have like any thoughts? So like, how would you talk to somebody that just feels like they don't, there's no need for a will or trust, any kind of estate planning?
Good question. So I get that question 80% of the time mm-hmm. when somebody comes in my office.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have anything. Yeah, you do. But it's just how you have it set up.
Yeah.
Most of us have our wealth in either in a house or in investments or bank accounts where you have beneficiaries and things that are already on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you look at it as far as, well, I don't have $1 million in a safe deposit box, well, you maybe not, but you still have assets. And so even if it's nothing more than just a simple will, where you set forth, this is who I want to have what.
Mm-hmm.
Because there may be some items that you cannot name a beneficiary on. And so just say, obviously, your bank accounts, you can name a POD or beneficiary. With your, obviously, with life insurance policies, that's the whole point. You got a mm-hmm. beneficiary. With most investment accounts, you can name a beneficiary.
Mm-hmm.
But just say if there's some other assets that you don't have a beneficiary named on or can't name a beneficiary. Some like retirement benefits, you can't name a beneficiary. And so in that case, then that will would come into play to make sure that that person, those assets go to who they want them to go to. So again, if it's nothing more than just a simple will, I think it's important. And then, like I mentioned, if depending on the person's circumstances and you know what the assets are, if they want a more of a level of control, then, you know, a trust may be in order,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I found, too, that, you know, not only with the statistics that you recited, you know, us as Black men are more hesitant.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, majority of my clients are female. The mm-hmm. you know, the females tend to have more of an awareness, I guess, and a willingness to discuss these type of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And but surprisingly, once they can drag husband or dad or not, you know, even more so the case, daddy,
mm-hmm.
you know, older guy into the office, and I talk to him, it's almost like a weight, you know, that falls off of him. Oh, this wasn't as bad as I thought,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then they're glad that they went ahead and went through, you know, the process of getting all this stuff taken care of. And the way I operate, I'm going to sit down with a potential client and let them know, you know, how I feel in terms of what they need.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to try to upsell them on a trust if I don't feel like they need a trust.
I think that's a lot of Black people's thought process. They think that you're trying to either take something from them.
Right.
Or like set them up for failure. So yeah, I think they get like spooked out before they even give it a chance.
That's right. And in some cases, maybe rightfully so,
yeah.
depending on who they've had contact with, you know, and what they've been told.
Yeah.
You have some lawyers, that's what they're all about. I mean, they're gonna try to upsell you and put you in the highest, you know, bracket or whatever mm-hmm. they do for the highest fee. You know, but if it's something that I honestly feel that the person does not need, you know, then I'm going to say, hey, I don't know if you really need a trust. Now, if you want one, fine, we'll draft it, you know. But I think what you all are doing as far as getting the word out is very important, because there is that fear there, mm-hmm. that hesitancy, you know, that somebody, that it's, you know, something's going to be taken. I'm going to end up in, you know, worse off going through this than if I hadn't done anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
Mm-hmm. So is a lawyer needed to do a proper estate planning, or is it like, yes?
Well, I'll say this. This is my example for that.
Mm-hmm.
If my brakes on my car need changing, I mean, I can, you know, I remember they used to have books in AutoZone. You can go in and get your yep. book or get online. And I could get out there and fumble around and try to change my own brakes.
Mm-hmm.
But you may not want to be riding in front of me once I pull up. You know, so that's all the example I give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a legal document. I know there's a lot of commercials and things about, you know, these various companies that will draft these documents. But in a lot of cases, either they're not state specific, because there's certain things that certain states require, you know, even down to how the document is supposed to be signed and witnessed, you know, and that's a lot of times what I've seen with not only we call them homemade wills, you know.
Yeah,
that's
I was going to talk to you about that, because my grandma.
Okay, we'll get to that. Okay.
Yeah, I was like, homemade, grandma, this is not okay.
Or wills that are from some of these companies where they don't even meet the bare minimum, you know, standard of how they're supposed to be signed and witnessed. Mm. And the person ends up spending, or the family ends up spending more money on the back end trying to correct these mistakes than what, you know, the loved one could have spent, you know, on the front end getting it done correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, the main thing is, you know, hopefully finding a lawyer that's honest and going to give you, and obviously that's knowledgeable in this area, and so that person can be treated fairly and don't have to think, you know, even consider, well, just doing this myself, you know. I mean, and I, you know, on the other hand, I've seen documents from companies that are in order, you know, but, you know, if you can locate, you know, someone that you can trust and feel comfortable handling your legal affairs with, I think it's better to have it done that way. And even beyond the state-specific requirements, that, you know, there's certain things that, even in trust, I'm handling a trust for a couple of ladies in East Tennessee. I mean, we've gone back and forth, I know, 5 times on the language on certain things, that they wanted to state one thing, but I'm knowing legally this may not be the effect of what you're trying to say.
Mm.
And so if they do it themselves, not having counsel of how this may play out, you know, on the back end, then it may not be valid, you know. And one thing that helps me is, because I handle the litigation side, the trust lawsuits and all that, I see on the back end how these things actually play out, rather than just sitting in the office cranking out documents. You know, so that litigation side is helpful, you know, in the estate planning, estate drafting. So, But did you want to talk about the homemade will now?
I guess a little bit. I think they have talked her into going to get a will, or they may have gotten her a will. Mm-hmm. But I do know that she has shown me her handwritten piece of paper that she signed. Like, of course she signed it in front of everybody so they could see her do it.
Right.
But I think it's more so she is older. Like, so I think the thing is, the assets that she has is the house, the land, and stuff like that. And I think her goal is, the reason why she wouldn't want to get a will, is because she doesn't want any of her kids to feel like, you know, it's not fairly set up. So I think with her head, she's like, well, this makes it the most fair if I don't do that, and if they just know, hey, I want all of y'all to split it.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell her all the time, I think, like, well, if you, it's 4 different personalities. Mm-hmm. In my head, I just would think, if you don't do it, then at some point, it's going to be an argument, just because not everybody might have the same thought process that you're having and the intention that you might be having behind it.
Yep.
And I also think that since she's older, when you mention it, I think she takes it as, y'all think I'm about to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you can change somebody's thought process about that, because it's not like, no, we think you're about to die, we want your stuff. I think it's more of like, we want you to be comfortable with however it might end up.
Right.
So what would you say, I guess the question is, how would you present it to, like, somebody in your family that isn't necessarily as open to the idea? Because I think, honestly, even when my grandpa passed away, like, I just don't think that she would think of, like, how the situation may affect everybody else.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So most of the problems I see when someone dies and they haven't had these, and then there are disputes, it's frankly when the person didn't sit down and discuss this stuff, you know, and where, because I always tell clients, these are your assets.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to give $10 to him and $1,000 to him, you know, that's your decision. If you want to name her as the executor and not him, you know, because obviously parents know, you know, their children, mm-hmm. or whoever their loved ones, and who has the strong suit in this, and you know, whatever, mm-hmm. who's more dependable in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can tell, you know, just as clear as day, those cases when someone has died and they come in and they're ready to fight and feud, that there was no communication.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think there's communication, but I think it's just. It depends on who she's talking
yeah,
to.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because I've seen situations where, and a lot of times it's us as men, you know, we kind of can be quiet on things and not want to address them, where you know, daddy told one daughter this,
mm-hmm.
then she went and got a will and took him and got a will, then daddy told daughter number two this. She go take and get a will.
Yeah.
Then when daddy died, we got two wills floating around.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to hurt nobody's feelings.
Right. Yeah, I think it comes down to the feelings.
She don't want to hurt nobody's feelings
at all.
You know. And but the thing of it is, I think to your point, they need to, is, you know, and sometimes people are stubborn and stuck in their ways and they're not gonna.
Yeah.
Nothing's gonna change it. But I think at least to tell them, hey, you know, this is gonna be problematic whenever you pass away, you know. And I know you don't want the family tore up.
Yeah.
And I know you want us to see us at peace with each other whenever you pass away, you know. And so, but if we don't get all this clear now and on the table, it's gonna be a mess, you know, yeah. when you pass away.
So the handwritten piece of paper that she has, that she made us watch her sign, that's not really anything. Because in my head, it's something, but I don't know, yeah. like, what you would do. You would,
yeah.
Could you show this to somebody and say, okay.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's called a holographic will.
Okay.
So the Tennessee does recognize holographic wills as long as all the, what's called the pertinent provisions are in the handwriting
mm-hmm.
of the person and it's signed. And, yeah. So it, you know, I've probated, you know, plenty of handwritten wills.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure, because when she did it, I was just like, grandma.
Yeah, yeah. And see, the problem comes in is when people try to get a will offline or a company that's got fill in the blanks
uh-huh.
and they write in it. Mm-hmm. And
she did real handwritten, watch her sign and everything. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a case once where I was on the other side trying to defend against it, where this guy had written out some language on some checks. And it didn't really make sense, but the people that were going to receive the stuff, they swore them down it was a will. You
right.
know? Oh, you see on this check, he want 2 million. No, that ain't, you know. And so, but in kind of researching and preparing for that case, I mean, the case law, you know, is kind of generous. You know, the law wants to try to respect a person's wishes
mm-hmm.
If it can be determined what the wishes are,
mm-hmm.
even if it's kind of some here, some there, whatever, mm-hmm. and it's not just in the most formal format, you know. But you know, that case, we never reached a conclusion. I think one of the people got in trouble, went to jail or something, and so the case we end up getting dismissed, mm-hmm. you know, in my client's favor. So we never got it before the judge for the judge to decide whether or not this was an actual will. But to your point. It can be a handwritten will, you know.
Okay.
The problem is, though, with handwritten wills, is it still has to have what's called testamentary intent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got to be clear that the person is trying to actually give this person something.
Yeah.
Because sometimes in handwritten wills like that, it might say, I want my daughter to have control over such and such, you know.
Gotcha.
And that does that mean you're giving that to her, or that means you just want her to have control of it to do something else with,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that's sometimes the problem with a handwritten will. It may not be clear that the person is actually trying to actually give this person that asset, you know.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk to her about that.
So what are the dangers of not having a designated beneficiary or a power of attorney? So I know, like, when, you know, you're getting a job and you gotta do the beneficiary for the life insurance and things like that, they say, you know, make sure somebody's down there, but if it's a minor, then this will happen. I know you spoke to that a little bit, how like a minor can't directly receive stuff, so it'll have to be a right. guardianship in general. But so what are some of those dangers, or like, you know,
mm-hmm.
the difficulties that you've seen in some cases. Mm-hmm.
So if I've seen situations where, and I always advise my clients to make sure that their beneficiary designations are up to date. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not somebody on that has passed away.
Right.
You know, because in some cases you may have an option to name a primary beneficiary and what's called a secondary or contingent beneficiary.
I think I've seen that.
Yeah. And then, and if that's the case, then the primary is deceased, and obviously we'll go to the secondary. Mm-hmm. But if there's no option to name a secondary and the primary is deceased, then those funds go through that deceased, that person's estate. Mm-hmm. And then that, now it's got to go through court. And so that's one, you know, precaution, I guess, you know, preventative or whatever, is to make sure that all that stuff is up to date. But I mean, other than that, I mean, if it's, I mean, if the beneficiary is on there, I mean, that's usually the issue, is just making sure that it's up to date. And I guess another thing I would say is making sure, and this is kind of in general, that if you have estate planning documents, as important of having the documents is letting somebody know where the documents are, you know, and who to contact. And, you know, I got retirement benefits with this company, and this is who you call to find out who, you know, how to claim those assets, mm-hmm. you know. But that's really my advice as it relates to, you know, to beneficiaries on you know, assets like that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I guess I can just ask like a question that I was wanting a little bit of advice on.
Okay.
What would you say, would you advise somebody, like, what would be your one piece of advice for somebody that's like in their 20s? Because I don't even think about wills, trust, or anything like that. Like, I have never really thought about it. But I do know if I was to pass away, that whatever I do have, like in my bank account or something like that, that it would go somewhere. And right. if I don't have anybody named on it, then right. it goes, I guess, back to the state. I'm not sure how that works.
Right. Well, obviously, you know, different stages in life, marriage, children, necessitates, you know, the corresponding plan or whatever. Mm-hmm. So for someone, you know, in their 20s that's not married, you know, obviously if you things that you can name a beneficiary on, mm-hmm. then you do that, mm-hmm. whether it's your mother, parents, or whoever, sibling, whoever. And I guess another thing to consider is if the same person is going to receive the asset through a will or not, then it may or may not make that big of a difference. You know, just say if I leave everything to my wife and kids, I mean, if I pass without a will, I mean, they're going to receive those things too. Now, of course, that doesn't account for them have, you know, they may have to go to court. Then that's the whole problem with, you know, making sure I got my estate planning documents. But, you know, it even with powers of attorney and all that, I guess, you know, the assumption is, you know, that you're younger, you're in, you know, your health is, you know, good health, and it, you know, declines as you get older. But I guess, no, you can never be too, you know, proactive, mm-hmm. in having, you know, someone named as a power of attorney. You know, it's obviously the more, like I said, the older you get, the more vital these things are. But, and then, you know, once you get older, obviously you can modify things, change things accordingly. But most certainly, you know, someone that's married and has children, I think it's vital for those people to make sure they have their, at least some form of some sort of estate planning. Not really. I mean, because really, for the most part, most people set up trusts for kind of the long-term benefits of it, you know, and which doesn't really have as much to do with current income. It's really more so of what you have that's set up as a lump sum that you plan to transfer into the trust, whether it's a some sort of investment account or whatever, to go into the trust in one lump sum, as opposed to, now you can set up, you know, a trust account and put money into it, you know, along the way, you know, but to answer the question, it's really, I never really get into the person's income. It's really what the accumulated asset is or what you anticipate going into the trust at some point. And it may not be anything necessarily ready to go into the trust immediately. You know, you can set the trust up to where, as far as we call it funding the trust, is how you get assets into the trust. It's where you may name the trust as the beneficiary on an account. So that asset won't go into the trust until you pass away. Mm-hmm. And then it's managed through the trust, as opposed to, just say if you got a life insurance policy. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to naming individuals directly on the policy to get the money directly, then you name the trust. The money goes into the trust and it's administrated according to the terms of the trust. So yeah, it really doesn't get into the income of the client.
And then the second question, as far as like a revocable trust, I know you can't take them out once the irrevocable trust has been solidified, but can you put more assets in?
Yeah, you can put more assets in, but once they're in,
they're in.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess another thing, the reason why trust is such a hot topic now is because I feel like a lot of people are becoming more aware of like how the Rockefeller grew their wealth.
Uh-huh.
So in respect of like the Rockefeller family trust, are you familiar with it?
Somewhat.
Somewhat. Mm-hmm. All right. As far as that goes, I know that they pretty much kind of have like an irrevocable trust and habit. So how would someone kind of set that type of estate planning up, I guess?
Longevity of a trust.
Yeah. Now that's really done in conjunction with, you know, a financial advisor.
A fiduciary financial advisor?
Yeah, to kind of determine, you know, the best way to get those things set up and the growth and stuff on that. So, you know, I'm not a financial advisor, but in a lot of cases, the financial advisors will work hand in hand with the estate planning attorney to get those things set up. So it's kind of a joint effort between the estate planner and the financial advisor on those. Another advantage of a trust is, you know, there are certain tax advantages when you talk about death taxes and things, but to be frank about it, in Tennessee, well, first off, Tennessee does not have an estate tax. They got rid of it. So there's no death tax in Tennessee. There is a federal estate tax, but it's like $11 million. you got to have more than $11 million and per person, and like $22 million per couple. Mm-hmm. In order to have any tax implications. And so it's, you know, that's not a whole lot of folks that's really in that category, striving to get there, right.
So that's all the questions that we have for you today. We definitely want to thank you for coming out and giving us this knowledge. Okay. So we can go forth and
Thank you.
Definitely going to take this knowledge back to our families. Mm-hmm. And into our own planning and get these things documented, and probably going to call you up to get it all.
Got to.
Officially. Yeah. Okay, I appreciate that.
Give us your information.
Website is www.childresslawoffice.com. Phone number 901-290-0650. Email kevin@childresslawoffice.com.
And we'll have all of that in the show notes and the description of the episode. Make sure you guys follow our social media pages. Yes. It's a wrap.
It's a wrap.
10th, like, comment, do it all.
Subscribe.
All of the things. Share it with a friend.
Yes.
Share it on your social media.
If you have a TikTok, make a little video, send it.
Let us know you're out there watching, guys.